Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to episode 570 with my guest, Dave Anthony. This is a replay of an episode that was originally recorded in 2012, the second year of the podcast. And this was voted as one of the listener favorites from that year. And it's one of my favorites. There's a lot of laughter and a lot of talk about codependency in this episode with Dave. And I really like it. Hope you like it too. Our sponsor this week, as always, is BetterHelp.com online counseling. That's BetterHelp.com. They have tons of licensed and qualified therapists. They're licensed in all 50 states. BetterHelp is actually available worldwide now. And you can get started talking to a counselor in under 48 hours. And all you need to do is go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor that they feel is a good fit for you, they will match you up with one. And you can experience some counseling and get 10% off your first month of it. And, you know, therapy is definitely a chemistry thing. As I mentioned before, I was with the same counselor at BetterHelp for about 3 years, and then she had to leave to take care of her critically ill husband. And so I am looking for a new counselor now at BetterHelp. And I'm working with a woman named Heidi, and she's definitely different than my old therapist. She's kind of more matter of fact, and her area of expertise is on, or at least what we're going to focus on is helping me be more productive and reach more of my goals. So I'll let you know how it goes. Anyways, BetterHelp.com/mental. And without any further ado, here is that best of episode with Dave Anthony.
I'm here with Dave Anthony, and we've been talking about getting together and doing this for going on, what, 15 years?
Something like that, yeah. I mean, we talked about it before you even had a podcast, as
before
I recall.
Before we met,
yeah.
There's about a half a dozen people that I keep meaning to have on the podcast, and every time I bump into them, I'm like, do a homework. Oh, God!
Yeah.
And I know the fans of your podcast, Walking the Room, I'm one of them, have some of them listened to this show also and really want to hear you come on. And we've joked about it. I was on the Walking the Room's 100th episode, and we joked about what would happen if you and I brought our drunken Irish depression and rage together in a room.
An anger vortex
that it could only end. And I can't remember what did we call it?
I don't remember.
Where one of us would have to jerk off while the other one shot himself in the head, and it would be called a double shamrock. I think that's what it was called.
Yeah.
But I first of all, I want to plug, not that it needs plugging, but I want to plug your guys' podcast. It's called Walking the Room. You host it with Greg Barrett, and it is just the fucking greatest.
Thank you.
It's so funny and honest and dark and wrong, and it's like every. I don't know, how would you describe it to somebody that's never heard it before?
I mean, I would say that we go, like, nothing's out of bounds.
And you guys are parents, which I love so much, that you say the shit that you know parents must think about parenting, but you say it.
Totally, yeah, I think so. I think when we sat down and we first decided to do it, it was like, let's just be as honest as we can about everything, about what's going on in their careers, about the kids, about, like, all of it.
Yeah.
And so that's what we go for.
Like in the span of 5 minutes, you will talk about how much you love your kids and how they did this thing that, you know, warmed your heart. And then in 10 minutes later, you'll be talking about laying a jizz bomb on somebody's back.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, that's.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, but it's so.
But that's life. I mean, I know that people try not to do that, but I remember. You know, Greg Giraldo, who passed away, a comedian, he was once asked about why he is sometimes really dirty or just goes there. And it's like, because that's life. That's what our podcast is. It's life. Like, sometimes I'm super filthy. Sometimes I'm, you know, loving and honest or whatever. I'm angry. Like, it just goes all over. That's just what it is. And that's what I think podcasting is for. It's to hear something you don't hear in other places.
Yeah. And hear the dark stuff, and it's so nice when you hear somebody else voice a thought that is maybe a little over the line, but you've thought it or felt it, and you're like, oh my God, that's so cathartic.
Yeah.
So cathartic. And plus, you guys are just fucking funny, and you have a great chemistry. Dave is kind of known as the angry curmudgeon on the on the podcast, you know. You certainly aren't play acting.
No.
You're a pretty angry guy. Is it something that is a constant issue with you, or is it talk about your anger?
I think it was more a constant issue before. Like, when I hit 35, I sort of realized how to deal with it and where it came from and all that. But yeah, no, it was completely destructive up until then. Completely destructive.
Where would be the best place to start? You want to talk about what it was like growing up?
Well, we can, because without that, I don't think you understand the anger. I mean, I grew up with a serious alcoholic and a Al-Anon mother. So my mom was raised by two serious alcoholics. So then she, of course, married an alcoholic, because that's what you do. So she was shut down as a human being, and he was a neglectful alcoholic. So I was literally, when people say they were raised by wolves, like, I was raised by wolves. Like, I was raised by people who weren't there.
Just not interested in you.
They just weren't. Yeah. I mean, they just couldn't be. It was beyond their capability.
Yeah.
And my mom tried as much as she could, but my mom said to me a few years ago, she said, "You disappeared when you were three. I just saw you go inside of yourself and you didn't come out again until you were mid-30s.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. She literally said she saw it happen, where I just kind of vanished inside of myself. And
did you do like a magician flourish? Did you do it?
I threw down a flash pot, a smoke bomb, and then and then when the smoke cleared, I was just inside of myself.
That's so fucking sad, though, man. It's three.
You're three. I know. When she told me that, because that came about because I had basically had it was basically a breakdown. I mean, I think. I don't know what you'd classify it as, but when I was in my mid-30s. And I went back to talk to her and like just lay it all on the line. And she was like, yo, this is the first time I've seen you come out of yourself since you were three. And I was like, what? And she's like, yeah, I just saw you disappear inside yourself. And she lays a lot of that on my dad, but she also cops to she wasn't really able to be there.
She didn't know how.
And she still isn't on a lot of levels. She's just not, she's not a, they're not like loving parents, you know? I just don't have that, and I never will.
What, are you at peace with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm totally at peace with it. You know, I love my mother, and it's just a sort of a distant relationship. I mean, she still drives me insane because she's my mother, but she's there and I can talk to her about stuff, but she's really just sort of has a narrow path as she walks in, and she can't deviate from it, and she can't conversationally, she can't deviate from it. Like it's just that she wants to talk about things that are bad or wrong or things that aren't going well. And there's just not a lot.
She does or does not want
She to? Does. That's all it is.
Oh, so she's pretty negative.
Yeah. Yeah. Very negative.
Yeah. My mom will do that sometimes. She will, it's like a switch will flip and she will just go on these angry monologues that will, I could put the phone down and cook an entire meal.
Totally. And they're, and for me, they're monologues I've heard before.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm like, okay, here we go. This one's kicking off.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then she wants to know about what's wrong in my, like all the questions are always like, oh, so how's that going? Is that going okay? Hoping it'll be like, well, it's not working out. Oh, see? Yeah, I get that. Like that's when she relates. So that's how I grew up relating, you know?
So negativity was kind of like currency.
Yeah, totally.
And you were rich.
I was loaded, man.
So what kind of seminal moments stick out in your mind from childhood, adolescence, that kind of?
There were, so my dad was a really big drunk and my parents got divorced when I was,
Did he ever win any awards?
Did he win awards for being a drunk? Really big drunk?
Yeah,
actually.
He just never showed up to collect them.
He was, he's a member of the Native Sons of the Golden West. So yeah, he would occasionally win awards for like,
I don't know what that is.
That's like think of the Elks Lodge, but for Californians.
Okay.
And so he would like win president of the lodge and that just meant you really knew how to party.
Yeah. Was he a fat?
No, not a fat guy. No, he like exercised and stuff.
No. Was he a vet?
No, he wasn't fat. No, no he wasn't a vet. No, he was an attorney.
Okay.
So.
No, I meant a veteran.
No, I know.
Okay.
I was saying he's an attorney, so sort of the same thing. No, those guys aren't vets. Are you asking if the Native Sons of the Golden West guys are vets?
Yeah, for some reason I thought Elks Lodge might have been military veterans.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, literally to get in the Native Sons of the Golden West, you just have to be born in California.
Oh, okay.
And then you go to the lodge and you drink. It's pretty great.
Yeah.
So there are like moments that stand out are like... So my parents got divorced when I was in second or third grade. And then I would go see him on Sundays. And that was always like, so he had he remarried to a woman who was also an alcoholic. And this is one of the biggest things is every Sunday I'd go over to his house. She would take a bath in the middle of the day, bombed out of her mind, and then sit in the tub and scream about how horrible me and my sister were to herself. Fucking little brats, spoiled little fucking cocksucker piece of shit. Like, that's what it would be for like an hour. And he would never go in and tell her to shut up.
Are you shitting me?
I swear to God. He would just sit there and act like it wasn't happening. And I would just be like, well, this is odd.
Oh, my God.
So... you know, what you take away from that is that, oh, no one is protecting me at all. I'm on my own. He never let me win a game of anything my entire life. Checkers, basketball, whatever it was, I never beat him. Like, that's fucked up for a kid's, like, self-esteem. Like, you gotta give him one. He would drive, he would pick us up, he would drive to a bar and say, I gotta go in and cash a check at Matucci's. and he would give us a couple of dollars to go to the Taco Bell next door, and then he would go in there for like 4 hours.
And you would just sit at the Taco Bell?
We'd sit in the car for like 4 hours.
Oh my God, the rage you must have felt.
Well, yeah, and so when people are like, oh my God, you're so angry or what, like, that, trust me, it's all for a reason. It all exists for a reason. I had a terrible father, like beyond unbelievably bad.
I remember one time this guy, I was like 14 and, you know, you're trying to get money for weed and this guy was like, I don't even know how I met this guy. He was like 35 and he was like, yeah, I need to clean out a storage shed. I'll pay you a couple of dollars to come help me. So I helped this guy clean out his storage shed. And on the way home, he stops at a bar and says, I just got to go in and talk to somebody. And I'm sitting in the car and I'm not kidding you. After like 25, 30 minutes, I began to feel such rage.
Yeah.
I felt like I wanted, there was like a ball of tears in my throat. I can't imagine what it would be like for that to happen time and time and time again from your fucking dad.
Father. And the thing is like, yeah, it goes from you being angry at the moment to just being angry all the time. Yeah. Like eventually it just transitions into you're just angry. That's just what you are. That's your state, your natural state then becomes anger. Yeah, so I talked to my sister about it because my sister would be there too. It would be the two of us just sitting there. And she was 2 years older. And she was like, I don't know why I ever didn't just get out of the car and walk home. And it would have been about a 2 mile walk. But she's like, I could have easily walked home. And then he would have come out of the bar and been like, where are my kids? Well, they're home. They walked 2 miles home. While you were in the bar, like, and who that would, you know what, that would have had absolutely no repercussions. Like, he would have been mad at us or something, but it would have been a nice thing to do for our self-esteem.
Is he still drinking?
Yep. Yep. That's never going to stop. He's, I had to talk to him about it. Well, there's a couple talks I had. When I had my like breakdown thing, I went out to lunch with him and I hadn't talked to him in 3 years because when I was living in New York, I was doing stand-up living in New York. I decided to not call him and wait for him to call me. I just made a decision one day.
Let's see how long it takes for him to notice.
All right. I was at home and my beeper went off. That's when we had beepers. My beeper went off and it was my dad. And I was like, and I called him and I go, why'd you beep me? He goes, well, I tried you at home. I go, you didn't try me at home. I'm sitting at home right now. He just didn't want to pay the long distance call.
Oh, my God.
So I thought, Then I hung up the phone. I thought, I'm going to wait until he calls me. 3 years. And not like 3 quiet years. 3 years of my grandmother calling me going, how come you won't talk to your father? And me going, I will. He just has to call me. Like 3 years. And then finally after 3 years, after I went through all my stuff, I called him up and I just, let's have dinner or lunch or whatever it was. And then we sat down and he talked about his alcoholism and he said, you know, his quote was, I have a monster living inside of me.
Wow.
Yeah. And when you hear that, you're like, okay, well, that's a little bit different than what I have. But apparently that's my wife, who is a psychologist, says that is a common thing that you will hear.
I
have a monster living inside of me.
I relate to that. I'm an addict and an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a great way, but having your father tell you that is what I was wowing.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. So I went to support groups and I like worked through it all and heard a lot of stories that I related to, that kind of stuff, you know. And then I went on a podcast, I went on Mark Maron's podcast and I talked a lot about my dad and he listened to it. And then I got an email from him. This is the other thing. Like, he doesn't know how to communicate. Like, he doesn't call you. He doesn't know how to talk. So he'll email. Like, he had stomach cancer, and I found out from an email. The email was literally, hey, Dave, I have stomach cancer. I'm having a lot of my stomach removed tomorrow in the hospital. Love, Dad. Like, that's how I found out my dad had cancer. So he wasn't good at communicating. So after I did the Mark Maron show, and I talked about him a lot, he contacted me and just said, I heard a lot of interesting stuff. And I was like, okay, does that mean he heard it or does that mean he just heard it?
And how does he feel about what he heard?
Right. So, I called him and we talked. And then this is on the first couple episodes of my podcast, because that's right when we started ours, 1 and 2. So I think it's all covered in there. So we talked in it, and it was one of those conversations where you want to, like, what you want to hear is, I'm sorry, I blew it, I was in a bad place, I wasn't a good dad, that kind of thing. So what I would say, hey, you weren't, I said, hey, you weren't there for me. I didn't get what I needed from you. In my opinion, that was because of how much you drank, that kind of stuff. And his response was, ha, yeah. Like, so there are so many different responses in your head that you think can come, defensive or this or that. But like, it was so just like, huh, yeah. So like, weirdly matter of fact that it was just like, that was so bizarre that it was cathartic in that he just isn't there.
Yeah.
There's just nothing there.
Well, plus, you know, too, if you, the thing you have to understand about alcoholism, and you may know this already, but people become emotionally frozen at the age that they begin escaping into whatever their addiction is.
Sure.
So even though you are talking to a guy who's in his 60s or 70s, you are really talking to probably an 8 or a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
Trying to have an emotional conversation.
Yeah, and that's exactly how it feels. Like, it's just not, it's not happening. It's not there. It's not in him. So, you know, that was, for me, it was a good thing. For, it was just bizarre, and thank God I had, you know, gone through support groups and therapy and whatever else, because it just didn't, like, it just didn't have the effect it would have 10 years before. It would have devastated me, or I would have just been more enraged.
You would have still been trying to get the, some juice from that rock.
Yeah. And there's no juice coming from that rock. There isn't. It's a rock.
There isn't.
So, and now I'm at the point where I don't even talk to him anymore, because, like, last Christmas, yeah, we're done. I'm kind of done with it, because last Christmas I went up to, he's now turned really angry and very political, and the opposite of my political beliefs. And so we went up, and he just came into my sister's house on Christmas and just launched into me. Like, it was just insane. And it was all really conspiracy, not tethered in reality stuff. And my sister watched it, and she just said, yeah, you guys don't have a relationship at all. And I was like, yeah, I don't. And so I'm just done. I mean, it's sad that I have a kid now, and that's what the choice I have to make, but it just is.
That's so awesome, though, that you can accept that.
Yeah.
And not try to get into the insanity of thinking you can control it and make it something other than what it is. You've done all that you can.
Yeah.
You've expressed your feelings to him. You've given him a chance to try to change.
Yeah.
And you've realized,
well, I've handled it from every different angle. I've ignored him. I've expressed nothing but rage towards him. I've done self-destructive things to myself. I've tried to be kind. I've tried to be loving. Like, it's all out there.
What were the self-destructive things?
My whole career up until I was 35. Everything. I sabotaged myself from, I would say, from the time I was 12 to never succeed at anything, because he wanted me to succeed so he could go to the bar and brag.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I would hear that, like, if I did stand up on a TV show, he would never say, hey, good job, or hey, that was great, I watched it. I would just hear that your dad showed me your stand-up is a tape, or like, I would hear from other people, and it's like, so you're using me as a thing to brag to other people, but you don't say it to me. So then I started sabotaging my own career to stop him from feeling any joy.
That is in the dictionary under biting off your nose despite your face.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, who knows how far it would have gone if I didn't, you know, get my shit together. And it's still something I fight through. You know, I always have to fight, like, stopping myself from.
Well, I need some highlights of this self-sabotage destruction, because
I can tell you when it started. I know the biggest event in my childhood was, I was on a baseball team, and he was the coach, and we had some sort of disagreement. And he wouldn't take me out of a game. So I stood at the plate, and I didn't move the bat off my shoulder, and it was strike one, and it was the ninth inning, you know, like a time I needed, you know, strike two, strike three, and then I turned around to the opposing team's bleachers and raised the bat above my head and said, yeah! That kind of shit. Like, that was just... And then you get into stand-up, and I was the guy who would get into arguments with people and turn my back on people, and like take the club owner of Cobb's, who really wanted me to succeed. Now, he was nuts, but he really wanted me to succeed, and he had really high hopes for me.
Cobb's is a very prestigious comedy club in San Francisco.
Yeah, and so what I should have done was gone in and done my work and try to improve myself and better myself and use that stage time he was giving me to just work on my stand-up. But what I did was embroil myself in some weird relationship with him where we would drink and get in fights and scream at each other all the time. And then I would purposefully do what he didn't want me to do on stage. He used to hate that I would gather my thoughts by looking up at the ceiling. And one time he put a sign up on the ceiling and said, "Why are you looking up here, Dave?" And then I proceeded to just stare at the ceiling all the time. Like, that's the kind of shit I would do. It wasn't like huge sabotage, but that's enough to make a guy go, "I'm not going to book you anymore because you're doing exactly what I tell you not to do." So that's the kind of stuff I would do over and over and over again. And like, when I was in New York, I was with an agency and I fired my agency at 3 a.m. by email. Like, just stuff like that. You just don't do that. I seriously set my career back. I could have been. That's my biggest regret in life, is just the fact that I fucked up. And I get that I can't. I guess sort of beyond my control at that point. Like, I was just a train out of control. But it is my biggest regret, is that all the opportunities that I had that I just blew. Just blew. Repeatedly. Also, because I was super judgmental about everything, you know? So I would set stuff up to be like, "Well, I'm not going to do that." Like, an example is Bob Odenkirk and his wife came out to New York, and Bob took me out to, we went out and we like ate, and he's like, "I want you to write for the show I'm doing. I want you to submit stuff. You're really funny. I love your stuff. I've always liked your stuff. I want you to submit for my show." And I was like, "Fuck that. I'm not going to be in some stupid sketch show. I don't want to be involved in that shit."
It was Mr. Show?
Yeah. Like, that's the kind of stuff that my career is just littered with. And later he hired me on a show after Mr. Show to write on a pilot that didn't get picked up, but it was like too little too late, you know? But that's it. That's like the epitome of my career.
Do you think it's possible, though, that all of that, and maybe this is just me, you know, Mr. Silver Lining, but do you think it's possible that all of those experiences have been necessary to inform this part of your life?
Yes, without a doubt. It's made me a better person. I think if I had had success early, I would be a worse person. I mean, you know, because...
I agree. I think if you had had success with that rage...
It'd be a monster.
Be an absolute monster.
And we know those people. We know those people who got success and are monsters. Like, Hollywood is littered with them. That's just not a fun way to live. And they think that by getting success, which I did, I thought that by getting fame and success, that was going to be the thing. And then as you get older, you go, "Oh, that's not the thing. That's not the thing at all."
It's just a different set of pressures. And then you feel, because you have so many different things going on, so many fires, you begin just having more people to blame for the anxiety and the fear and the unfulfilled sick fantasies you have in your head.
Yeah.
So you just begin, and people in this town don't call you on it because they think they might need you later if you continue to be more successful. Yes. So they enable you.
Totally.
And
people are making money off of you, so they're making 10% or whatever it is, so they don't, they
they're not
going to
tell you you're a fucking monster. Right.
Not at all. They're not going to say anything about it. I can't even imagine what I would have been. Like, I think I would have been the worst of the worst. Just.
I have to agree. I mean, it's... Yeah.
I mean, it's like, okay, let me just say this. I didn't have, and people can't understand this. I mean, the number of people that can understand this is very few in the world. I didn't have a feeling until I was 33. I was all anger. I was different levels of anger. And then after I started going to therapy and support groups and all that, I like all of a sudden started having feelings as a human being. Like, oh, this is happiness. Like, it was just crazy.
Can you talk about what that process was like and what you remember thinking and feeling?
I remember, the first thing I remember is the first feeling I felt after coming out of whatever. I mean, it was a profound depression that I was in, which manifested just through pure rage. So,
and let's remember to talk about the meltdown before we're over. I certainly don't want to skip over that.
Yeah, sure.
Or should we talk about that before we talk about the therapy?
The meltdown came after all of this. Meltdown came after I started work. I mean, that's, you know, happens a lot. You start working on yourself and then you go, holy shit. And then you start feeling feelings and you go, holy shit.
Yeah.
This is awful.
No wonder I escaped.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is before. So we can talk about it, this way. So I was in a relationship. That relationship ended and it was, 6 or 7 years ago. We moved out from New York together, living together. She went back to New York. I was trying to work my way through it, and I started going to support groups and therapy. And then I started feeling like it was just writing stuff down, and it was just listening to other people's stories and going, oh, I get that. And sort of being in a safe place where basically you go to a support group, it's like creating a family that you didn't have.
Exactly.
And that's what you're looking for. You can find the father figures, the brothers, the sisters. That's who my family is. They're, I mean, besides my sister and her kids, my family really, they're my friends. So then you start to have all those feelings that you never had because people are actually being there in the way that your parents should have been there for you. And then the anger starts to recede a little bit. And when the anger goes away, then there's feelings. And I remember the first feeling I had was sadness. And I was overjoyed because I had never felt the feeling before. And it's so, that's the sad thing is that, to me, the saddest thing of all of it is that, and I don't know what age that was, that, like you said, you stop at a certain age. That might have been me being 3 again, which is really fucked up that I just missed all those years. So, like, who knows when I stopped feeling my feelings as a kid, but that's just so sad that's 33 is when I started going, oh, it's sadness. This is cool. Like, I remember being sad and being like, this is awesome that I'm sad.
And I don't imagine you would have been able to see that as a positive thing unless you had been through therapy and support groups.
Correct. I would have been totally mortified and terrified by it and wouldn't know.
Humiliated and think this is a wrong feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went through that, I didn't date anyone for 2 years. Because I just wasn't capable. I was like, I can't even, like I was just like, I got to fix myself before I go near anybody else. And then I met someone through the support groups and fell pretty hard. She was in the process of getting a divorce and she couldn't deal with being in a relationship. So she bailed and then I just lost it. Just totally fell apart. Like couldn't function, like could not function as a person. I remember after a month, I was sitting on my couch and I had 2 cats and just, I looked around and I was like, there's like a layer of cat hair in my entire, like covering my entire apartment. There's a layer of cat hair. And I was like, I haven't cleaned or done anything in a month. The really funny thing is I felt like I couldn't, like everything that I wanted to hold on to was just slipping away. Like my career had fallen apart. I had no money. I couldn't clean. Like it was just insane. I remember I sat down on the couch and my pants ripped up the back and I was like, fuck, I can't even have pants. Like, like it was just so like everything has to go to start again. And that for me was like the thing, like, okay, no pants, no nothing. Everything has to go. Like I have to completely start over again. So I did. I started going to even more support groups and doing more therapy. I started reading a lot of Buddhist literature, which really helped me. just for being like, for me, it helped me just go like, this is just, it is what it is the saying that people despise. But for me, it means a lot.
Yeah,
it is. This is just what it is. This is what the path I was given. If I fight against it or feel, oh, poor me, or fucking, oh, I'm angry about it. It just I just had a shitty start. So that's just what it is. That's how I feel about my life now, is like, it's just my path, and I can't fret over the shit that happened. Like, cause it's what's the point? What, then you're just fighting with yourself. You know, that's all anger is you're just fighting with yourself
and denying reality.
I mean, it comes out against other people, but you're hurting yourself far more than anybody else. So I got my shit together. I remember I stopped, like I moved into a new apartment. I didn't set up I had no television. Like I just went really minimal, and it was like basic stuff, like clean, do the dishes, like take care of your basic shit. And I just sort of reform myself as a person, and then that girl came back.
Really?
Yeah. Now she's my wife.
No way.
Yeah. The one who broke my heart and sent me into all that tailspin came back, and she was like, "Wow, look at you. You're different and better." And she had gone through her own process.
You have less cat hair on you.
I had less cat hair on me, and it was like, you know, I was a completely different person at that point than she had been just 6 months before. And if she hadn't done that, if she hadn't broken up with me, I would have never gone through that shit that I went through. And I would probably still be in that weird state of like half fixed. And even Greg, like I had stopped talking to my podcasting partner, Greg, in that time. And I'm not sure when in this span it is, but I went back to him and apologized for all the shit that I had done. And, you know, a lot of it was on me.
You know, the thing that strikes me about that is what I hear over and over and over again with the people that go to support groups, try to broaden their perspective by, you know, getting into some type of spirituality, going to therapy, all of those things to get different points of view, is that they begin to see that there is, that the universe kind of forces you sometimes to go to the gym for your soul.
Yeah.
And you hate it at the time, but after doing some work, you're like, this is awesome that mm-hmm. I have had to develop these tools to survive.
Yeah.
Now I'm better than normal
yeah.
because I can take these tools and these experiences, and when new shit hits me, I'm fucking equipped.
Yep. Yeah, for the most part, I'm equipped. I mean, you know, here and there, obviously.
Yeah, it's certainly not like you're never going to make mistakes. You know, mm-hmm. that's certainly a fantasy, is to think that we're yeah. not going to fuck up, we're not going to get angry, we're not going to disappoint people.
Yeah.
But it's so much better than...
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me, which I haven't touched on at all, was being a victim. Like, because of the way I was raised, I was just victim.
And be the easiest thing in the world with your story.
Of course.
To be stuck in that place.
And then you set up situations where you fuck something up and then someone gets mad at you and then you're the victim. Like, that's just the classic victim thing to do. And I remember, so when I was going through all this, I remember I was at the gym and I like went through like a thing where I like worked out all the time and like lost 20 pounds and was like skinny as shit and like, I went through that whole like classic thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was on the gym and I was on the
treadmill.
Treadmill I'm running. And I'm thinking, I really love to go to like a place like Nepal or something. And just cause like, I've always loved like being out in nature and like, and just like go backpacking or something. And it'd just be so fantastic to just like experience a place like that. And then I was thinking, and I thought, and then I'd probably be kidnapped. And then these guys would hold me hostage, and then no one would want to pay the ransom, and they'd probably kill me. And then I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, I can't even have a decent, like, fantasy about something. And that was the last time I ever, that was literally, like, my brain just went, no more victim shit, dude. That, like, literally that moment I went,
wow.
I turned it off.
Wow. And
I don't think I've had that mentality since, but I literally turned it off.
Wow. Do you still, do you consider yourself to be a Buddhist?
No, I don't practice enough, but the things I believe in, like I'm always going to eat meat, you know, but there's, The philosophy is amazing, and I do that. I follow. I believe that's why you had me write down fears before I came over here. I don't have a lot because the one thing I learned from that, and that was the whole process of me going through all that shit, was walking into the fear. Am I afraid of it? Step into it. Just do it. Step into it. So my fears mostly are now about my son or other things, but I don't have like fears of like these big things anymore because it's like whatever it is, I'll just walk into it.
So if you have fear of getting AIDS, just get out there.
Just get out and bang
around.
I cannot tell you how many like homeless dudes down on Skid Row that I've just gone and fucked just to get AIDS. That's beautiful.
I
that was a little bit of walk in the room right there.
That was a little taste of walking in the room. I don't know much about Buddhism, but I have memorized all of Patrick Swayze's lines from Point Break.
So you know.
Yeah.
That's basically the ultimate Buddhist manual.
I have the gist of it. I know that cars are metal coffins.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, there you go.
So where would be the next place to go to in your story?
Well, I don't know. I mean, now I'm in a weird place now because
have we gotten all the sabotaging highlights?
I think so. I mean, the crazy thing is the sabotaging. I mean, there were times like back then when in those early days of comedy, the Montreal Comedy Festival was an enormous thing. So they, like, I was getting a little bit of heat in New York when I was doing stand up there, and I had a big audition for the Montreal Comedy Festival, and so I slept through it. Like stuff like that. Like
purposely?
I literally went to bed at 4 p.m. and took a sleeping pill. And I had a set at 8 for the Montreal Comedy Festival. And then I woke up at like 9:30. Like shit like that. I did over and over and over. This is something that my manager stopped me from doing. So there were two comedy clubs, like the bigger ones when I was there were the Comic Strip in New York, New York. And they would all put their own, they managed comics also, so they would put their comics on at the really good spots. And then they started swapping comics. So I'll put your comics on, you put my comics on. So all of a sudden there was no time for anybody else. And I was so enraged by it that I contacted the New York Times. And then I sat down and had...
And you were benefiting from this, right?
I wasn't benefiting from it, but I was also doing just fine. Like, I was getting enough stage time. Like, but it was the injustice.
I see.
That I just couldn't accept. Like, that's my big thing. Is like, because that came from my father, right? Injustice. It's got to all be set right. Like, just insane.
Did they make you wait at Taco Bell while you were waiting to go on?
So, if you ever see me sitting at Taco Bell eating and crying, you'll understand.
Avoid.
So I actually contacted the New York Times and sat down with a writer, and he was like, so the story I'm going to pitch to my editors is like, it'll start with you and then it'll build all the way up to like the fact that now management companies and are producing and like how it's like crossed over all of show business. And my manager got a wind of it. He goes, are you out of your fucking mind? Your whole career will be over. You're literally talking about something that starts small and goes all the way up to the top of show business. And I was like, so fucking what? And he killed the story.
Wow.
Yeah. But that's the kind of stuff I did. Like, just because I wanted to right a tiny wrong.
Do you find yourself still wanting to sabotage things today?
No. No, I don't. No. I mean... If I'm on a job that I don't like, I might still have to control myself from like saying this is bullshit and walking out. But like, no, stuff that's like stuff that I want to do, stuff that I'm working towards. The only way I sabotage myself now might be from being a little lazy. But I also think that's from getting older. Like, I'd rather sit around the house than go out, you know, to the clubs.
I got an email from a listener kind of chastising me for calling myself lazy an episode or two ago. And it really kind of opened my eyes that it's it's like one of the worst things that you can say about yourself, because sometimes you need to chill out, or you need to just be.
Yeah, that's not what I do. I know what you mean, but yeah. I could work harder.
Yeah?
I could definitely work harder, yeah. Yeah.
I'll email that guy back.
I know what you mean, but you know, I don't put a lot of like if I want to write for a day, 4 hours is how much I'm going to do it. And if I want to write stand up, an hour, you know what I mean? Because I think beyond that I'm not being as productive. So it's not like I give myself huge like workloads.
You just made me feel so incredibly lazy.
Well, okay, so Will Anderson is this comedian from Australia, and he is maybe their most popular comedian, and I've become friends with him because of the podcast.
Yeah, and your podcast is huge in Australia.
Yeah, it's really big. It's kind of crazy because of him, like really, because he has a podcast called Tofop. And I went down to Australia. We did ours at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and I happened to go on a podcast that he and his friend does, and it's about the process of writing stand up. And they started talking about how they write, and I was like, What? You guys just don't think up an idea and then go on stage and fuck around with it? And he is like, no, I'm a stand up comedian. I write every day. I sit down and I make myself write. And I was like, what? And then I was like, fuck, I am way too old if this is what I want to do, just do it. So I've been writing every day, and I don't know what's coming of it, because I haven't actually gone out and hit the clubs like full force yet, which I'm going to do soon. But yeah, I'm trying to write every day. I'm trying to write bits. I'm trying to sit down and just write. And if nothing comes of it, it's just, then you're just writing thoughts, and and that's like therapy in a way. You're just getting the stuff out there on the paper.
And you feel like you're moving forward.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. That's the important thing. Yeah. I think, is that you're not just sitting there going, I'm not doing.
I am so much happier if I just write for an hour, if I'm just creative in some way. I've always been that way. If I hang pictures on a wall, I'm happier than if I just sit around and watch TV. You know what I mean? Doing, the act of doing.
Yeah. I'm happy. And then you can enjoy watching TV.
Yes.
You're like, yeah, you can. I hung a picture.
Yeah, then you don't feel bummed because you're watching The Housewives of Beverly Hills. Well, you should always feel bummed.
That picture over there of the Blackhawks Stanley Cup picture.
Yeah.
Sat on the floor underneath it until the anniversary of them winning the Stanley Cup, because I couldn't get up
for
the energy.
I have four pictures sitting. They've been there. My wife got them framed for me, I would say, in January. And they're of walking the room posters of their live shows, and they've just been sitting on the floor for 4 months. And I actually bought hangers recently. I went out and bought the little tip into the wall. Yeah.
Wait till the anniversary. It'll feel more special. I can tell you from experience. You get a little tear rolling down your face.
Yeah, that'll be nice.
We are brothers of different mothers. You and I, although I think your story is more extreme.
Yeah, I have a pretty extreme upbringing. I've learned that I wasn't beaten, and I wasn't. Well, I was beaten. I was just. I used to get hit with a strap, but I wasn't like punched and like had the show. I got punched once, but I wasn't like a kid who was like broken bones and like, you know, I was mostly neglected, and so I had this thing. So I had it really bad. I had it worse than a lot. There's others that had a lot worse. So I don't know.
And the thing that I always like to kind of stress on this show is, don't wear your story fits on the curve of pain and neglect is not important.
Right.
What is important is the feelings that you feel and the need to just go ahead and process them and talk about them. That's the important thing.
Sure.
Because you're not playing detective to try to come up with some blame so that you can go and blame somebody, and that's going to give you the catharsis that's going to make life okay. That's not how it happens. Actually, ultimately, you're going to want to be able to forgive that person, you know, to be able to move on. But the processing of the feelings and feeling that sadness that you had stuffed down when you were 3 years old.
Yeah.
That is what is important. And a lot of people can never get beyond the, well, I didn't get fucked, I didn't get beaten, so I just need to suck it up and not feel sorry for myself. And you stay stuck.
Totally. There's also people, artists, who think they need to stay broken.
Yeah.
Those are the people I feel really the most sorry for, because I don't think you can really become the artist you can be until you fix yourself.
Yeah.
As, you know.
The amount of, this is going to sound so pretentious, but the palette is so limited as an artist if you never forgive people and you never understand that other half of life that involves acceptance.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. The big wish I have is that I could talk about my father on stage, but I can't because people get so horrified. Like, the audience is just like, what?
Why is he laughing?
You're right. Like, I've worked beyond it, and I always wanted to get to a place where I could talk about it. And now I'm like, oh, I still can't, because they are just like, that's insane. Yeah. So, he'll remain out of the act.
Well, if we ever do a live show of this...
How would that go?
I don't know. I want to do it, and I don't know. I get some feedback from people, but I can tell you this. My audience would laugh.
Your audience would laugh. Here's the thing I would say about it, though, is that very hard, because you're talking about getting performers, and when they're on stage, let's face it, we all become something else.
Yeah.
And we put on a little bit of a show. So to find someone to sit there and be honest would be the challenge.
I think it would have to be people that this wasn't their first time on the show.
Sure.
So that their darkness has already kind of been out there, and now we're kind of at the stage where we can laugh about it. Or maybe the live show would be playing some type of game, you know, like how we do the Fear Off, maybe some type of thing like that. So it's not, you're not sitting there bringing up some awful memory, and other people are hearing it for the first time. Cause that's kind of a hard thing.
Weird. Come on down to the cry off.
Right.
Have you ever thought about, because you're fucked up that you wanted to do this podcast. You get that, right?
Yeah.
Have you explored that? Because my wife is a psychologist, and I think they're out of their fucking minds, because they want to sit there and hear people that are just going through the worst shit ever. Have you thought about the fact that why you want to do this podcast?
Yeah, there's two reasons. And I get this every time I get interviewed about it. People are like, what made you want to start doing this? And there's two things. One, I had gained a perspective about depression and darkness and addiction and how that can present itself as reality.
Sure.
And how I had believed that for years. And then when I was able to see it for the monster in camouflage that it really is, that it's not reality, I felt like I need to let other people know how this monster camouflages itself.
Yeah.
And the other thing is,
it really does camouflage itself.
It does. It's a fucking shape-shifting motherfucker. I think the Dalai Lama said that. And the other reason is it makes me feel less alone. When I have a conversation like I'm having with you right now, I get to be fully present. I don't question where I am in my life. I feel of use. I feel like I'm part of a family. Yeah. And so I do it half selfishly, half like I want other people to know that they're not alone.
Right.
But it doesn't, I get energized by the darkness if there's a perspective to it.
Sure.
If there's a light, just even if it's a little pin light, like we had Mike Carano was a guest a couple of episodes ago who was in a very tough place, who was just on the verge of, is ready to go get help. And that to me is, even though he's not gaining perspective yet, he does that hope is just a little pin light for him right there. That's enough. That's enough of a light for it not to be a sad situation, or to feel exploitive.
I remember that. I remember that pin light of someone being like, "You should go here just once and check it out." Be like, "Oh, well, yeah, that might be a thing."
Yeah. If this show was just me interviewing people that did not want to get help and were like, "Fuck that," I would be despondent.
Yeah, it'd be horrible.
So that's. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but.
And yeah, it does, actually. Or, I mean, besides that, because here, there's something deeper than just wanting to, like.
Oh, there's definitely a voyeur.
What I mean.
Oh, yeah. I'm a definite voyeur. Okay. I mean, the shame and secret survey that I have is a completely voyeuristic experience.
Yeah.
But. Part of that, you know, part of it is just the pure voyeur of, you know, I'm curious, I'm nosy. But the other part of it is since I've been a little kid, I've had this intense curiosity about what makes people tick. Yeah. I will watch any documentary about serial killers.
I used to do that.
I love.
Read all the books, the serial killer books.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Still do that?
Not so much anymore, but like one of the most fascinating, disturbing books I ever read was, I think it was called The Mind Hunter by John Douglas, who was he's the premier, serial killer profiler. He basically invented that whole FBI profiling thing. He was the guy that Silence of the Lambs, the FBI guy that it was based on. And he wrote this fascinating book about getting into the mind of these incredibly broken people and why they do what they do and their modus operandi and their signature and all of that stuff. That stuff is endlessly fascinating to me. So like the Shame and Secret survey on the website, I get to read that stuff every day. Not about serial killers, but about people's deep people that want to fucking leave their family behind.
Yeah.
People that are tired of fucking their spouse. People that want to fuck their dad.
Yeah.
You know, all of that stuff. That is just endlessly fascinating to me.
It is fascinating. Do you think, besides the voyeur part, because I have a theory about why people want to be psychologists, and it's that, because they come from broken places also, and it's that they are using it to recreate those feelings of sadness through empathy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, cause they've, a lot of them done a lot of work on themselves. So now they like to sit in it a little bit and feel it.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about that because sadness is not, it's not an emotion that I get off on or that I enjoy. When I feel it, I still my first instinct is to still run from it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I love more than anything is finding a similarity between myself and somebody else.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That's what drives me more than anything.
I think that's just an inherent human thing.
Especially when you felt like you were a freak and broken most of your life, which I felt most of my life that I was just a broken freak.
Oh, totally. I was completely like, I had a group of friends that I was friends with, but I was like the guy who'd never had a girlfriend and like couldn't really be close to anyone, and that guy. Yeah.
Do you want to do a fear off? Is there anything else you want to touch on before we?
A fear off is fine.
Okay. This is from a listener. I've listed so many of my.
It's a really big list.
It is.
That's what scared me.
Well, if
I mean, if, that looks like it's
if
almost.
If we put all my fears together from all the episodes that I've done, it would be about ten times.
Because you asked me to come up with fears, and it was hard for me to sit down and think of. Do you find it hard, and then they start coming, or can you just list them? I'm not a guy who can just sit down and. I'm not like Richard Lewis.
My first 200 fears were not difficult. It's getting difficult now to not repeat them. Yeah. Okay. Here's a fear that I had was that it was going to be difficult to get you to open up in this interview.
I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
It seems like it would be that guy because of my exterior. I'm not that guy. It right. would have been. I still carry the, as my friend called it, the I'm going to blow up a building eyes
yeah.
around, but it's not, I'm not that, like it's a little bit more of an exterior
yeah.
thing now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've been really pleased with how easy it's been to get you to open up.
This ends with a hot tub, right?
Here's what we do, Dave. We give each other back rubs and we let nature take its course. I am going to be reading fears from a listener named Allie, and
she's going to have more than me because I only have like 8.
Well, we don't have to do all of hers. We'll just go until we feel like stopping. She writes, "I'm afraid of getting mugged or raped."
Wow. I'm afraid of my son of dying before my son is grown. Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid of not getting mugged or raped because I am too large a person to merit getting attacked. Her fears are so fucking awesome.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's what I have written at the top of her thing.
That's amazing.
It just says great fears.
Those are fantastic. Wow. And I am, afraid of not being able to make a living.
I'm afraid that I'll die from cracking my neck and then the paramedics will see that I died watching King of the Hill reruns on Netflix wearing a $6 house dress from Walgreens. I fucking love this woman.
Oh, okay. My son, dealing with any sort of pain or anxiety.
I'm afraid of getting pregnant and having to go off of my bipolar meds and then killing myself because of my crippling depression.
Like, Jesus Christ.
She's good.
I'm afraid my chronic foot pain will never go away.
I'm afraid no one will want to marry me because I don't want kids.
I'm afraid I'll no longer be funny someday.
I'm afraid of getting my shoelaces caught in an escalator. I have that one.
Oh, yeah.
I always think about that
too.
Every single time I get in an escalator. Always.
But I think that was put into us by our parents, right? Wasn't that a yeah. big thing you'd say?
Yeah, it'll shoot you out like a potato chip.
I always was told my foot would be torn off.
Yeah.
I'm afraid of becoming irrelevant.
I'm afraid that I've peaked physical attractiveness-wise.
Hmm. Oh, I have. I'm afraid of bombing on stage.
I'm afraid my labia are too big.
Oh, me too.
I've seen yours, and I think yours are dainty.
No, you're right. Thank you.
If I could just, on that point, I've gotten more than a couple of women who feel that way, that that's a fear of theirs. There is a website, and it is a really rampant thing. There's a documentary about it, and the name of it escapes me right now. I'll try to remember it. But there is a website called Vaginas of the World. It's a Tumblr site, and this woman started it because she wanted to help fight. A lot of women are getting vaginoplasty and labia work done because they think that the vaginas you see in pornography is the norm.
No.
And so this woman started this website for women to anonymously post pictures of their vaginas so that everybody can see that there is no normal and that what women think is hideous is not. And people leave comments basically saying, you know, you're perfectly fine. You're
yeah.
lovely. You're don't change a thing. Do mm-hmm. not get surgery. And this listener had confided in me through I think it was a fear list that she hates her labia and feels that they're too big. And so I told her to go to this website and she said it blew her away. She felt completely different about her body after yeah. seeing that. And I can tell you when I went there, of course, immediately the yeah. first 5 minutes I was looking around, I was like, oh, look at all the vaginas.
Yeah, a lot of vaginas.
But after looking at it for a while, it completely changed my view of what the spectrum of vaginas is like, and it made me
the VS
the vagina spectrum. It's violet at the left end, and then bright pink on the right end. It made me feel two things. It made me feel a little sad when I realized the intense amount of self-hatred that women have yeah. about how their vaginas look. And it also made me realize what a variety there are out there and what how much pornography had fucked up my totally. View of what a vagina should yeah. look like. And I just want to recommend it for anybody out there that men and women to go check it out. And it's done in a very respectful way. If anybody posts anything piggish, this the woman that does it, you know, takes their comments.
Oh, really?
Because you do every once in a while. Yeah, you get some jackass that's, you know, a fucking troll.
That's a sweet pussy. I'd hit yeah. that. That kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, they do. Like, if they're complimentary ones like that, even she'll leave ones up like yeah, like that yeah. because.
But not like your vagina's horrible,
right? Like, yeah.
I would say that every vagina is like a snowflake.
I would agree.
Everyone is different.
I would agree.
So, just let your snowflake be.
And that ends this month in labia.
Oh, that'd be a great podcast.
Where are we? Your turn.
My father getting emotional before he dies.
You're afraid of that?
No, I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, because that'd be a tsunami.
It'd be a tsunami, and a lot of it's too little too late, but it's also like I don't have those feelings anymore. You know what I mean? Like it would be awkward for him to like get. And, you know, people do that at the end of their life, for him to get really emotional and me to be like, dude, that's just not what it is.
I put my wall up. I'm not ready to take it down
yeah.
again.
And yeah, I'm good.
Because there would have to be some re-injuring in
yeah.
moving back in closer to him.
Sure. It would open up a lot of shit that I just don't. I'm good.
Yeah. Allie writes, I'm afraid of bugs crawling in my ears and eating my brain.
Jesus Christ. I'm afraid about my neighbors finding out that I talk about them on the podcast.
Yeah. I'm afraid of having children and then fucking up their lives because their mother is mentally ill.
Wait. I'm afraid of having children and fuck... Oh.
She's afraid that...
Yeah. I'm afraid that I'll pass my anger on to my son. Yeah.
I'm afraid of being hated by strangers. I have that one.
You do?
Oh, yeah. I want everybody to love me. It's sick.
I give a fuck.
I want to get
seriously,
there.
Seriously, I just don't care. Greg has, my podcasting partner has it. Greg, I don't care.
It goes back and forth. When I'm in a good place, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
But when I'm not in a good place, it's like I need everybody to...
Do you read comments about the podcast? And
sometimes, yes. Sometimes, no.
Yeah. We're all there for you.
Your turn.
Is it my turn? I think I'm out.
All right, let's move into let's move into the love off.
Dude. Oh, shit.
Just go ahead and unbutton that shirt.
Wait, whoa. It's weird that the microphone moved when we got to the love off. Well, I mean, the obligatory, I love my wife and my son. Like, that's...
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to be reading the loves from Katie. Who is not only a listener, but a friend and a great supporter of the show. And she writes, I love when my cat lies on me and I can feel him purring while he breathes.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I love watching my son learn something for the first time.
I love clean laundry.
Mm. I love water. And there's more to that. I love, like...
Yeah, I was going
to
say, Jesus Christ.
I don't stare at the sink.
Yeah.
I love, like... Ocean, I love lakes, I love pools, I just love
just
being around water.
Yeah, something so calming about just looking at a body of water, even if there's a dead person floating in it. I'd be like, all right, it's all part of nature.
Oh, come on, India.
Yeah. Katie writes, I love when I know my favorite show has recorded and is ready to watch. I love that one.
Really?
Oh, yeah, like Mad Men or The Walking Dead. By the way, we should plug, are you still writing for The Talking Dead?
I might go back. If I have a show that they might make a pilot for on Comedy Central, and if that goes, then I won't go back. But otherwise, I will go back to Talking Dead, yeah.
How are you going to sabotage both of those at the same
time? I don't know. I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
I'll figure it out.
You could do like that guy in Publicly Jerk Off, who is the...
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Comedy Central, actually, they probably wouldn't bother them. They'd be like, this is good. This is some good free press.
Yeah. I love people who speak their mind.
I love when my cats cuddle and groom each other.
A lot of cat stuff going on here.
Katie loves her cats.
I love going to the movies.
I love when I fall asleep quickly without immediately worrying about the future.
Fuck. I love sitting on a porch and doing nothing.
Oh, that's a good one.
Right?
That is a fucking great one. I love when I wake up a bit before my alarm and I'm able to fall asleep for a few more minutes. Mm. I like that one.
I love writing.
I love when my fiance randomly sends me a funny or sweet text during the day.
Mm-hmm. I love watching my son laugh.
I love watching magicians. Does that include a 3-year-old Dave Anthony disappearing inside himself? What if that was one of her loves? My God, she was there.
I just snorted.
She was there.
I just snorted and almost knocked the microphone over. I love performing comedy.
I love new socks.
Fuck, I love new socks too.
It's great. After they're first washed.
Yeah.
And new underwear. I like new underwear.
Yeah, new underwear is a good one.
I will wear underwear until my wife is like, throw that shit away. You have holes in your underwear.
Yeah. I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I love clean sheets.
I love aimlessly walking around Target and browsing the never-ending amounts of shit I'll never need but always want. I like that.
Yeah. I love sitting and watching people walk around the Grove.
I'm going to read this one, even though it feels self-indulgent, but Katie wrote it. I love Fridays because it's fucking Friday and because new episodes of the Mental Illness Happy Hour get posted.
See? I mean, that was, you know... That was,
but I had to qualify it. I couldn't just read it because I was like, people are going to think I'm reading her fears because I'm so afraid that people are going to think I'm full of myself.
I think you are.
Yeah, I am.
I love waking up on Saturday mornings and watching European soccer. God.
I love when people say hi when I walk by them on the street or when they respond to my greeting without giving me a weird look.
Really? Yeah. How do you feel about that?
I do too. Oh, I completely
just
agree
random
with
strangers.
That.
You're good with that?
Oh, I love saying hi to strangers and getting a nice response back.
Here's what I love: finding a new sandwich place that makes awesome sandwiches.
Yes, especially if they're toasted.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to Potbelly?
No.
They're originally from Chicago, and now apparently they're spreading around. But they,
really?
Yeah.
That's
what their ad should just be. Oh, just. So fucking good. Yeah, they cook them in a wood-fired
really?
Oven. I think it's wood-fired, but it's an oven. I know that.
Yeah. And they're out here now?
I believe so. I know that they've spread beyond Chicago.
Right. I'll check it out.
All right. I love when someone I remember also remembers me.
This happened to me this morning, and it wasn't on my list, but I love I love when I'm able to drive from Sepulveda on Olympic all the way to Robertson and hit all greens.
Nice.
I was like, this is amazing. I couldn't have been happier.
Katie writes, I love Kraft macaroni and cheese and no, I'm not 5 years old.
Fuck, who doesn't? I love when I go to pick up my son and he runs at me yelling, Daddy.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's one of the best ones.
How does he feel though when you peel out and laugh at him?
It's weird.
As he stands there crying.
I say, welcome to my childhood.
Yeah.
You know, it's just getting back at him for the stuff my dad did.
Enjoy your chalupa. I'll be at the sports bar.
Enjoy your chalupa. They didn't even have chalupas back then. It was literally just burritos, burrito supremes. They had that beef burger thing and tacos. Like, they didn't have, it was like 5 items back then. It wasn't. They had fancy cups, though, with Bugs Bunny on them, so.
Katie writes, I loved a home-cooked meal.
Yeah, along those lines, I love everything about making a meal in a crock pot.
Yeah.
You walk in the house, the whole house smells, and you eat it, and it's amazing.
And the cleanup is simple.
It's so great.
It's all about the cleanup for me.
Yeah.
My wife says that I should write a book about how to make and eat a meal using nothing but my fingers and standing at the sink.
That would be a great book.
Yeah. Katie writes, I love getting super into a good book where I can hardly put it down and can't wait to pick it up again.
I love the first, like, really cold day of the year.
Yes. I love when something just clicks, like when I finally figure out the lyrics to a song. Are you done?
Yeah, that's all I had.
Then we'll end with Katie's last one. I love being a non-smoker and not missing cigarettes. Never fucking thought that would happen.
Wow.
That's a beautiful place to be.
I didn't think that happened.
It does. I smoked for a couple of years and then quit, and I don't miss them at all. But
really?
People that smoke for like decades and then don't miss them, I think that's amazing.
My wife is
one of them.
I thought you always wanted them.
No.
That's
not
great.
Not for everybody.
Yeah.
Not for everybody. But thanks so much, Dave. I really appreciate it.
This is awesome.
Many thanks to Dave Anthony. What a great guy. So much fun to hang around with. This episode is sponsored by Prolon. Extended fasting of at least 2 to 3 days has unique benefits such as cellular rejuvenation, an idea that was awarded the 2016 Nobel Prize in Medicine. And Prolon is based on that. It's a plant-based nutrition program that nourishes the body while making cells believe that they're fasting. My package just arrived. Each day has its own little container with very clear instructions on how you're going to do it. And I'm very interested to see how it's going to go. Prolon isn't a diet. Prolon is science. Right now, Prolon is offering Mental Illness Happy Hour listeners 10% off their 5-day nutrition program. Go to prolonlife.com/podcast. That's prolonlife.com/podcast for this special offer. That's prolonlife.com/podcast.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Let's see, a couple of notes before we go out. I have a really interesting survey response from the Shame and Secret survey that I want to read, but a couple of notes before that. If you are somebody who is in the public eye and you are a fan of this show and when you would be interested in coming on, please don't hesitate to email me. One of the things that I do like about having guests that are more, I don't know what you call famous or high profile, is I get a lot of responses back from people that are shocked that people in high profile positions or the public eye, they're shocked that these people's lives aren't magically better. And I would like to have more people like that on the show, and also selfishly because it will help the show grow and help me get to that place where I can support myself from doing it. Couple of things to mention before we get to that survey. You can support us non-financially by going to iTunes, giving us a good rating. That boosts our ranking, brings more people to the show, and you can help non-financially by just spreading the word through Reddit, Tumblr, all those other social media sites. The more you can spread the word, the more we can help destigmatize mental illness and get help for the people that need it, because this is a serious fucking thing. I know we joke around a lot, but, you know, what happened in Colorado, if that doesn't drive home what untreated mental illness can look like. And maybe that guy was treated. Who knows what his full story is, but I don't think there's any doubt that mental illness played a role in that. And, you know, like I said before, if you say you care about the victims, but you are not for more money going to mental health care for all Americans, you really don't care about the victims because you don't care about future victims. And that may be divisive of me to say that, but if you disagree, go fuck yourself. And I don't mean that in a funny way. I mean that in a truly go fuck yourself way, because it's exhausting living with mental illness.
I'm fucking tired of it. I'm really fucking tired of it, and I have access to decent health care. I get to see a psychiatrist. I get to see a psychologist. You know, I get my meds paid for through my wife's insurance. And a lot of people don't, and that's fucked up. We call ourselves the greatest country in the world. That doesn't strike me as a quality of a great country. I'm not saying this isn't a great country. I'm just saying there's a disconnect there. All right, enough of my soapbox. Let's get on to something more lighthearted, like a mother sexualizing her child. This survey comes from a guy who calls himself Proud New Papa. He's straight. He's in his 30s. Was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? He says some stuff happened, but I don't know if it counts as sexual abuse. My mother acted inappropriately with me on many occasions. She thought it would be funny to play grab ass with me until I was in college. She used to force me to kiss her on the lips until I was almost 19. When I would object to the kissing, she would get very mad and almost yell at me, making me feel ashamed that I wouldn't do something that made me feel so very uncomfortable. But worst of all was when I was 11 and 12 years old, she would try to get me to take my swimsuit off while swimming in our pool. It did not even re-enter my consciousness that this occurred until I heard Paul discussing his issues with his mother on the podcast. I have so much anger, guilt, and shame pouring through me daily because of this that it is affecting every aspect of my life, and I don't know what to do about it. Deepest, darkest thoughts. He writes, I have contemplated suicide at various points in my life since I was 14. I think often about just saying fuck everything and going off to live in the middle of the woods away from everyone and everything, which, by the way, of all the surveys I read, that is the most common fantasy that most people have, or dark thought, is they just want to cut contact with everybody and just move someplace else. He writes, there have been many times recently where the only thing that has stopped me from doing this are the fact that I would not see my two young children ever again. I also think that when my wife is late or hasn't called for a while, that something happened or she has died in an accident. Rather than calling to check on her, I start planning for my widower future in my head, contemplating how I would go about raising the kids without her, how I would involve her family and their lives, and how quickly I would have to sell the house and move back in with my parents, which would be the worst part of the whole thing, even worse than the fact that my wife was dead. Boy, do I get that one. The thought of having to move back in with an abusive parent. Wow. After a half hour of this, I finally realized that I should probably call and check on her. What are sexual fantasies most powerful to you? He writes, I have a fantasy of being completely degraded and just giving all control to my wife to be her servant. I want her to yell at me and beat me and recognize me for the piece of shit I am. I want her to fuck other guys in front of me and rub it in my face. I want her to just abandon me alone in the room while she goes and has an orgy next door so I can hear everything that is going on but be powerless to stop it. On the other hand, I want to completely dominate her as well, leave her tied up on the bed, force her to satisfy my urges, and make her have sex with a parade of women while I direct them all to satisfy my depraved desires. Man, I sound like a sicko, and I'm surprising myself by writing this. I feel disgusting. You're not disgusting. You are a human being, and do not feel shame about thinking or feeling that stuff. Would you ever consider telling a partner or close friend your fantasies? He writes, I try to mention bringing a new person into bed every once in a while, but I don't know how receptive my wife is to it, so I just stop bringing it up. Plus, it makes me feel like a perv to even acknowledge these thoughts. What are the deepest, darkest secrets things that you've done or things that have happened to you? He writes, I was the coordinator for a fundraiser in a college charity. I didn't trust the other people in the group to pay the money to the charity, so I deposited it into my bank account. Then rather than pay the money to the charity, I used it to pay my own bills. It was only $300, and I have donated more than that since then to try to make up for it. I once got a blowjob from a coworker in the stockroom when my wife and I were still dating before we got married. That was the only time I've ever had a woman swallow. And he also lists, I also find myself contemplating moments in life of extreme embarrassment and beating myself up over them to the point that I still can't move past them. I go all the way back to things that happened in elementary school, and I'm in my 30s and still feel like a piece of shit, and everyone is judging me for them, even though I know rationally that there is no way anyone currently in my life is aware of these things. Do these secrets or thoughts generate any particular feelings towards yourself? He writes, guilt, anger, hatred, insufficiency, worry. The fact that the blowjob is still in my spank bank worries me and makes me feel shame and remorse. You know, I'm sure anybody listening to this, hearing your survey, if you're listening, the person that filled this out, you are so hard on yourself. You know, what you went through is so difficult as a child because you had a parent who was denying who you were as a human being, and they were treating you like an object and using you, and that is incredibly fucking damaging. And I think you need to give yourself a little bit of slack. I mean, one of the things that you feel most guilty about is that you just had some money for a little while from this charity, and then you paid it back. I mean, boy, on the grand curve of humanity, of things that we've done, dude, you are a really good person. A really good person. But all the people in the world could tell you that, and until you feel that yourself, it's never going to make a difference. That's the thing that's so fucked up about mental illness and the damage that we've been through, is that stuff gets planted so deeply in ourselves. At the end of the survey, to the question, do you have any comments or suggestions to make the podcast better? He writes, since I started listening to the podcast, I've started to confront these issues in my past and begun seeking therapy. I still have a long way to go, but I know that I will get there, partially because of the work you are doing. My self-improvement is the most important thing to me right now because of my young children. I want to do anything and everything I can to provide a stable, warm, and loving environment for them and to be a pillar of support as they grow older. I know that I cannot avoid fucking something up, and by connection, them, but at least I can minimize the extent of the fucking up. And I owe this in part to you. Please continue the good work. Well, that's very sweet of you to say that. You know, I'm very flattered. And it also makes me feel good to know that there's somebody out there that has experienced what I've experienced. It sounds like yours was more extreme than what I experienced. But the thing that is awesome is that you can see that, like Dave Anthony talked about, it is time to move beyond being a victim. You know what happened. You know some fucked up shit happened. But now you are into action. And that is what an adult does. And I think that is awesome. And I think you are to be applauded. And you are a shining example of what is best about human beings, is their resilience. I heard somebody say something the other day. You can't think your way out of a thinking problem. You can only behave your way out of a thinking problem. And you are beginning to behave your way out of a thinking problem by going to therapy. And there you will learn other behaviors that will help you cure this cycle of negative thinking in your head that tells you that you're a piece of shit. And you are not. There's so many of us just like you. So many. And if you're out there and you're struggling, it can get better. And never forget that you are not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely.